But no. He must walk around to the foot of the stairs, where his father is lying, head downward and arms bent at impossible angles, praising the floor. Nick shouts and drops to help his father, but there's nothing left to help. He stands and takes the stairs, two at a time. But by now everything is as clear as Christmas, everything anyone needs to know. Upstairs, the two women curl up in their bedrooms and can't be wakened. A late morning sleep-in on Christmas Eve. Blur rises up his legs and torso. He's drowning in pitch. He runs back downstairs, where the old propane heater still cranks away, venting gas that rises and pools invisibly underneath the ceiling that Nick's father has so recently snugged up with extra insulation. Nick blunders through the front door, trips down the porch steps, and falls into the snow. He rolls over in the freezing white, gasping and reviving. When he looks up, it's into the branches of the sentinel tree, lone, huge, fractal, and bare against the drifts, lifting its lower limbs and shrugging its ample globe. All its profligate twigs click in the breeze, as if this moment, too, so insignificant, so transitory, will be written into its rings and prayed over by branches that wave their semaphores against the bluest of Midwestern winter skies. Mimi Ma. The day in 1948, when Ma Se-shin gets his third-class ticket for a crossing to San Francisco, his father starts addressing him in English. Forced practice for his own good. His father's magisterial British colonial speech runs rings around Se-shin's own electrical engineer's functional approximations. My son, listen to me. We're doomed. They sit in the upstairs office of the Shanghai complex, half company trading house, half family compound. The enterprise of Nanjing Road percolates up to the window, and doom is nowhere to be seen. But then Ma Se-shin is not political, and his eyesight is that of a man who has worked too many math problems by candlelight. His father, scholar of art, master calligrapher, patriarch with one major and two minor wives, can't help lapsing into metaphor. Metaphor embarrasses Se-shin. This family has come so far, from Persia to the Athens of China, you might say. Se-shin nods, although he would never say any such thing. We Hui Muslims have taken everything this country threw at us and packaged it for resale. This building, our mansion in Hangzhou. Think of what we have outlasted. Ma resilience. Ma Shouying gazes out into the August sky, staring at all the calamities the Ma Trading Company has survived. Colonial exploitation. The Taiping Uprising, the destruction of the family's silk plantations by typhoon, the 1911 Revolution and the 27 Massacre. His face turns toward the room's dark corner. Ghosts are everywhere, victims of violations that not even the philosopher magnate who hired a pilgrim to go to Mecca for him dares to name out loud. He spreads one palm on the paper-stacked desk. Even the Japanese couldn't break us. History gives Se-shin a rash, the random ebb and flow. He'll travel to the States in 4 days, one of a handful of Chinese students in all of 1948 to be granted visas. For weeks he has studied the maps, gone over the letters of acceptance, practiced all the inscrutable names. USS General Meigs, Greyhound Supercoach, Carnegie Institute of Technology, For a year and a half, he's attended matinees of movies with Gable Clark and Astaire Fred, practicing his new tongue. He plows on in English out of pride. If you want, I stay here.
Want you to stay?
You have no idea what I'm saying. His father's stare is like a poem. Why do you linger at this fork in the road, rubbing your eyes? You don't get me, do you, boy?
Shouying pushes up from the chair and crosses to the window. He looks down the Nanjing Road, a place as eager as ever to profit from that bedlam, the future.
You're this family's salvation. The communists will be here in 6 months. Then all of us. Son, face facts. You're not cut out for business. You should go to engineer's school forever. But your sisters and brothers, your cousins and aunts and uncles, Hui traders with lots of money. We won't last 3 weeks once the end comes.
But the Americans, they promise.
Ma Shouying crosses back to the desk and takes his boy's chin in his fingers.
My son, my naive son with his pet crickets and homing pigeons and shortwave radio. The Gold Mountain is going to eat you alive.
He releases his son's face and leads the way down the hall into the bookkeeper's cage, where he unlocks the grate and shoves aside a filing cabinet to reveal a wall safe whose existence Su Xin never suspected. Shouying extracts 3 wooden flats wrapped in satin rags. Even Su Xin can tell what they contain. Generations of Ma family profit, from the Silk Road to the Bund, sunk into movable form. Ma Shouying rakes through handfuls of sparkling things, considering each for a moment, then chucking them back into their trays. At last he hits on what he's after. 3 rings, like small bird's eggs. 3 jade landscapes that he lifts to the light. Su Xin gasps.
Look, the color!
The color of greed, envy, freshness, growth, innocence. Green, 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 and green. From a pouch around his neck, Shouying produces a jeweler's loop. He sets the jade rings in the light and peers at them for what will be his last look. He hands the first ring to Su Xin, who stares at it as at a rock from Mars. It's a sinuous mass of jade trunk and branches several layers deep.
You live between 3 trees. One is behind you, the lot, the tree of life for your Persian ancestors, the tree at the boundary of the 7th heaven that none may pass. Ah, but engineers have no use for the past, do they?
The words confuse Su Xin. He can't read his father's sarcasm. He tries to hand the first ring back, but his father is busy with the second.
Another tree stands in front of you. Fusang, a magical mulberry tree far to the east, where they keep the elixir of life.
He palms the loop and looks up.
Well, you're off to Fusang now.
He hands the jade over. It's detailed beyond belief. A bird flies above the topmost tangle of foliage. From the crooked branches hangs a row of silkworm cocoons. The carver must have used a diamond-tipped microscopic needle. Shouying presses his magnified eye up close to the last ring.
The third tree is all around you. Now. And like now itself, it will follow wherever you go.
He gives the third ring to his son, who asks,
What kind of tree?
The father unwraps another box.
Dark, lacquered wood unfolds on two sets of hinges to reveal a scroll. He undoes the scroll's ribbon, which hasn't been loosened for a long time. The scroll unrolls into a series of portraits, wizened men whose skin droops more than the folds in their robes. One leans on a staff in a forest opening. One peers through the narrow window in a wall. Another sits underneath a twisted pine. Sir Shin's father taps the air above it.
This kind. Who these men are? What they do?
His father regards the script, so old Sir Shin can't read it.
Luo Han. Arhats. Adepts who have passed through the four stages of enlightenment and now live in pure, knowing joy.
Sir Shin doesn't dare touch the radiant thing. His family is rich, of course. So rich that many of them do nothing anymore. But rich enough to own this? It angers him that his father has kept these treasures secret, and Sir Shin isn't a man who knows how to get angry.
Why I don't know about this?
You know now.
What you want I do?
My word, your grammar is atrocious. I assume your instructors in electricity and magnetism were more competent than your English teachers.
How old this? 1,000 years? More?
One cupped palm calms the young man. Son, listen. You can only store a family fortune so many ways. This was my way. I thought we would gather these things and protect them. When the world returned to sanity, we'd find them a home, a museum somewhere, where every visitor would connect our name with... He nods at the Luo Hans playing on the threshold of Nirvana.
Do what you like with them. They are yours. Perhaps you'll discover what they want from you.
The main thing is to keep them out of the hands of the communists. The communists will wipe their asses with them.
I take these to America?
His father rolls up the scroll again, wrapping the frayed ribbon around the cylinder with great care.
A Muslim from the land of Confucius, going to the Christian stronghold of Pittsburgh with a handful of priceless Buddhist paintings. Who are we missing?
He places the scroll back into its box, then hands it to his son. Taking the box, Sir Shin drops one of the rings. His father sighs and stoops to retrieve the treasure from the dusty floor. He takes the other two rings from Sir Shin's hands.
These we can bake into mooncakes. The scroll? We'll have to think.
They put the trays of jewels into the safe and push the file cabinet back in front of it. Then they lock up the bookkeeper's cage, seal the office, and go downstairs. They pause outside in the Nanjing Road, thronged with people doing business, despite the looming end of the world.
I bring them back,
Sir Shin says,
when my school is done and everything's safe here again.
His father gazes down the road and shakes his head. In Chinese, as if to himself, he says, you can't come back to something that is gone. With two steamer trunks and a cardboard suitcase, Ma Su Xin takes the train from Shanghai to Hong Kong. There he learns that his health certificate, acquired at the American consulate in Shanghai, isn't good enough for the ship's medical officer, who must be paid another $50 to examine Sir Shin again. The General Meigs has just been decommissioned and transferred to the American President Lines for use as a Pacific passenger liner. It's a little world, 1,500 people wide. Sir Shin bunks on one of the Asian decks, three stories beneath daylight. The Europeans are above, in the sun, with their deck chairs and liveried waiters serving cold drinks. Su Xin must shower with dozens of other men, under buckets, bare naked. The food is vile and hard to keep down. Waterlogged sausages, pasty potato, and salted ground cow. Su Xin doesn't care. He's going to America, to the great Carnegie Institute, to get a graduate degree in electrical engineering. Even the squalid Asian quarters are a luxury. No falling bombs, no rape or torture. He sits in his berth for hours, sucking on mango stones, feeling like the king of creation. They dock in Manila, then Guam, then Hawaii. After 21 days, they reach San Francisco, port of entry for the lucky land of Fusang. Su Xin stands in the immigration line with his two trunks and flimsy suitcase, each stenciled with his English name. He's Su Xin Ma now, his old self turned inside out, like a jaunty reversible jacket. Colorful patches cover the suitcase, stickers from the ship, a pink University of Nanking pennant, an orange one from the Carnegie Institute. He feels carefree, American, filled with affection for people of all nations except the Japanese. The customs official is a woman. She looks over his papers. Is Ma your Christian or family name?
No Christian name. Only Muslim name. Hui.
Is that some kind of cult? He smiles and nods many times. She narrows her eyes. For a panicked moment, he thinks he's been caught. He lied about his date of birth, putting down November 7th, 1925. In fact, he was born on the 7th day of the 11th month, the lunar calendar. The conversion is beyond him. She asks him the length, purpose, and location of stay, all detailed in his paperwork. The whole conversation, Su Xin decides, is a crude test of his ability to remember what he's written down. She points at his steamer trunks.
Could you open that, please? No, the other one.
She inspects the contents of the food box, three mooncakes surrounded by thousand-year eggs. She gags as the tomb is opened.
Jesus, close it!
She picks through the clothes and engineering texts, stopping to examine the soles of a pair of shoes he has repaired himself. She lights upon the scroll box, which Su Xin and his father decided to leave hidden in the open.
What's in here?
Souvenir.
Chinese painting.
Open, please.
Su Xin blanks his mind. He thinks about his homing pigeons, about Planck's constant, anything except this suspect masterpiece that will, at very least, bring down customs duty far in excess of his stipend for the next 4 years, or, at worst, get him arrested for smuggling. The agent's face wrinkles at the sight of the arhats.
Who are they?
Holy people.
What's wrong with them?
Happiness. They see the true thing.
And what is that?
Su Xin knows nothing about Chinese Buddhism. He has only a rough estimate of English. Now he's supposed to explain enlightenment to this American woman official.
The true thing mean human beings so small and life so very big.
The agent snorts. They've just worked this out? Su Xin nods.
And this makes them happy?
She shakes her head and waves him through.
Lots of luck in Pittsburgh.
Su Xin becomes Winston Ma, a simple engineering fix. In myths, people turn into all kinds of things. Birds, animals, trees, flowers, rivers. Why not an American named Winston? And Fusang, his father's mythic land to the east, turns, over the years after Pittsburgh, into Wheaton, Illinois. Winston Ma and his new wife plant a substantial mulberry in their bare backyard. It's a single tree with two sexes, older than the separation of yin and yang. The tree of renewal, the tree at the universe's center, the hollow tree housing the sacred Tao. It's the silk tree on which the Ma family fortune was made, a tree to honor his father, who'll never be allowed to see it. He stands near the planting, its black ring of soil like a promise at his feet. He won't wipe his muddy hands even on his dungarees. His wife, Charlotte, scion of a fallen southern planting family that once sent missionaries to China, tells him, "There's a Chinese saying, when is the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago. The Chinese engineer smiles.
"Good one."
"When is the next best time?" "Now."
"Ah, okay."
The smile turns real. Until today, he has never planted anything. But now, that next best of times is long and rewrites everything. Countless nows pass. In yet one more, three little girls eat cornflakes underneath their breakfast tree. It's summer. The mulberry puts forth its messy clusters of achenes. Mimi, the firstborn, 9 years old, sits among the fruit spatters with her little sisters, her clothes stained red, bemoaning their family's fate.
"It's all Mao's fault."
A Sunday morning, midsummer, 1967, with Verdi blasting out of their parents' locked bedroom, as it has every Sunday of Mimi's childhood.
"That pig Mao! We'd be millionaires if it wasn't for him!"
Amelia, the youngest, stops stirring her cereal into a paste.
"Who's Mao?"
"World's biggest crook! He stole everything Grandpa owned."
"Somebody stole Grandpa's stuff?"
"Not Grandpa Tarleton. Grandpa Ma."
"Who's Grandpa Ma?"
"Chinese Grandpa,"
Middle Carmen says.
"I've never seen him."
"Nobody's ever seen him. Not even Mom."
"Dad never saw him?"
"He's in a work camp, where they put rich people."
Carmen says,
"How come he won't ever talk Chinese? It's suspicious."
One of the many mysteries their father is so generous with.
"Dad stole my poker chips when I was beating him."
Amelia pours milk from her bowl to feed the tree.
"Stop talking," Mimi orders. "Wipe your chin. Don't do that. You'll poison the roots."
"What does Dad even do?"
"Engineer, dope."
"I know that.
I drive the train. Toot toot.
He wants me to laugh every time."
Mimi tolerates no stupidity.
"You know what he does."
Their father is inventing a phone no bigger than a briefcase that runs off a car battery and can travel anywhere. The whole family helps test it. They must go out to the garage and sit in the Chevy. "Phone booth," he calls it, every time they make a long-distance call.
"Don't you think the labs are creepy?"
Carmen asks.
"How you have to sign in like it's a big prison?"
Mimi holds still and listens. Verdi pours out of her parents' upstairs window. They're allowed to eat under their breakfast tree, but only on Sunday. On a Sunday morning, they could walk to Chicago, and no one would even know. Carmen follows Mimi's gaze.
"What do you think they do in there all morning?"
Mimi shudders.
"Will you get off my wavelength? I hate when you do that."
"Do you think they touch each other naked?"
"Don't be gross."
Mimi sets down her bowl. She needs clarity and a place to think, and that means getting altitude. She steps up into the low V of the mulberry, heart pumping.
"My silk farm," her father always says. "Only no silkworm."
Carmen shouts,
"No climbing! Nobody in the tree! I'll tell!
I'll squash you like a bug!"
This makes Amelia laugh. Mimi pauses in the stirrup. The fruits dangle down around her. She eats one. It's sweet, like a raisin. But she's sick of them. She's had so many already in her short life. The branches zigzag. It bothers her, so many different shapes of leaves. Hearts, mittens, crazy Boy Scout hands. Some are furry underneath, which creeps her out. Why would a tree need hair? All the leaves are notched with three main veins, like the three of them. She reaches up and snaps one off, knowing the horror that will follow. Thick, milky tree blood oozes from the wound. This, she thinks, is what the worms must somehow turn into silk. Amelia starts to cry.
"Stop! You're hurting it! I can hear it scream!"
Carmen looks up at the window that Mimi is trying to reach.
"Is he even Christian? Whenever he goes to church with us, he never says the Jesus stuff."
Their father, Mimi knows, is some other distant thing. He's a small, cute, smiling, warm, Muslim Chinese guy who loves math, American cars, elections, and camping. A long-term planner who stocks up sale items in the basement, works late every night, and falls asleep in the recliner to the 10 o'clock news. Everyone loves him, especially kids. But he never speaks Chinese, not even in Chinatown. Now and then he'll say something about life before America. After butterscotch ice cream, or on a cool night around the campfire in a national park. How he kept pet crickets and pigeons in Shanghai. How he once shaved a peach and put the fuzz down the blouse of a servant to make her itch.
"Don't laugh. I still feel bad. 1,000 years later."
But Mimi knew nothing much about the man until yesterday. An awful Saturday, when she came home from the playground in tears.
"What happened? What you do?"
She squared off in front of the man.
"Are Chinese all communists who eat rats and love Mao?"
At last he talked to her. A story from another world. Much was lost on Mimi, but as he spoke, her father turned into a character from a late-night black-and-white thriller full of dark corners, eerie music, and a cast of thousands. He told her of the stranded scholars, changed into Americans by the Displaced Persons Act. He described other Chinese who'd come with him, including one who went on to win the greatest prize in science. It stunned Mimi. The U.S. and the communists were fighting over her father's brain.
"This man, Mao, he owe me lot of money. He pay me back. I take this family to a very fancy dinner. Best rat you ever eat."
She cried again until he assured her that he'd never even seen a rat up close until Murray Hill, New Jersey. He hushed and cooed.
"Chinese eat many strange thing, but rat not so popular."
He took her into his study. There he showed her things she still couldn't grasp a day later. He unlocked the filing cabinet and removed a wooden box. Inside it were three green rings.
"Mao, he never know about this. Three magic ring. Three tree. Past, present, future. Lucky I have three magic daughter."
He tapped his finger on his temple.
"Your father always thinking."
He took the ring he called the past and tried it on Mimi's finger. The twisting green foliage mesmerized her. The carving was deep, branches beyond branches. Impossible that anyone could carve a thing so small.
"This all jade."
She jerked her hand, and the ring flipped to the floor. Her father knelt down and swept it back into the box.
Too big. We wait for later.
The box went back into the file cabinet, which he locked again. Then he crouched in his closet and removed a lacquered case. He placed the case on his drafting table and undid the ritual of latches and ribbons. Two flicks of the scroll rollers, and there, spread in front of her, was China. The half of her no more real than a fable. Chinese words tumbled down in columns, swirling like tiny flames. Each ink stroke shone as if she had just made it herself. It didn't seem possible that anyone could write like that. But her father could, if he wanted. After the flowing words came a parade of men, each a chubby skeleton. Their faces laughed, but their skin sagged. They seemed to have lived for hundreds of years. Their eyes smiled at the best joke in creation, while their shoulders bowed under the weight of a thing too heavy to bear.
Who are they?
Her father studied the figures.
These men?
His lips tightened like the smiling figures.
Luo Han. Arhat. Little Buddha. They solve life. They pass the final exam.
He turned her chin toward him. When he smiled, the thin gold edge of his front tooth flashed.
Chinese superhero.
She wriggled free from his hand and studied the holy men. One sat in a small cave. One had a red sash and earrings. Another paused on the edge of a high cliff, with crags and fog trailing off behind him. One leaned against a tree, as Mimi would lean against her mulberry the next day, telling her sisters. Her father pointed at the dream landscape.
This China, very old.
Mimi touched the man under the tree. Her father lifted her hand and kissed her fingertips.
Too old for touch.
She stared at the man, whose eyes knew everything.
Superheroes?
They see every answer. Nothing hurt them anymore. Emperor, come and go. Qing, Ming, Yuan. Communism, too. Little insect on a giant dog. But these guy?
He clicked his tongue and held up his thumb as if these little Buddhas were the ones to put money on in the run of time. At that click, a teenage Mimi lifted from her own 9-year-old shoulders to gaze at the Arhats from high up and years away. Out of the gazing teen rose another, even older woman. Time was not a line unrolling in front of her. It was a column of concentric circles with herself at the core and the present floating outward along the outermost rim. Future selves stacked up above and behind her, all returning to this room for another look at the handful of men who had solved life.
Look the color,
Winston said, and all her later selves collapsed around Mimi.
China, surely a funny place.
He rolled up the scroll and put it in its case back on the closet floor. In the mulberry, Mimi thinks that if she could ascend another few feet above the earth, she might look into her parents' window and see what Verdi is doing to them. But down on earth, revolution erupts.
No climbing!
Amelia yells. Get down! Shut your trap, Mimi suggests.
Dad! Mimi's in the silk farm!
Mimi drops to the ground, a foot from crushing her little sister. She grabs the kid's mouth and gags her.
Shut up, and I'll show you something!
With the perfect hearing of childhood, both sisters know the something is worth seeing. In another moment, Under cover of the swelling Verdi chorus, they creep together, commando-style, into their father's office. The filing cabinet is locked, but Mimi opens the lacquered box. The scroll unrolls on Winston's drafting table to the image of a figure seated underneath a gnarled, patient tree.
"Don't touch! They're our ancestors. And they're gods!"
As much as he loves anything in life, the Chinese electrical engineer who brings his family into the garage to make long-distance calls to their Virginia grandparents on a car phone bigger than a Yule log loves his national parks. Winston Ma spends half a year planning the annual June ritual, marking up maps, underlining guidebooks, taking neat notes into scores of pocket notebooks, and tying strange trout flies that look like tiny Chinese New Year dragons. By November, the dining room table is so full of preparation that the family must eat their Thanksgiving meal, clams and rice, in the breakfast nook. Then vacation comes, and they're off again. The five of them crammed into the sky-blue Chevy Biscayne with roof rack and back seat as wide as a continental shelf, no air conditioning, and a cooler full of juice on ice, logging thousands of miles on trips to Yosemite, Zion, Olympic, and beyond. This year, they return to his beloved Yellowstone. Every campground along the way gets an entry in Winston's notebooks. He writes down the campsite number and evaluates it according to a dozen different criteria. He'll use the data over the winter to perfect next year's route. He makes the girls practice their musical instruments in the back seat. This is easier for Mimi on trumpet and Carmen on clarinet than for little Amelia and her violin. They forget to pack books. 2,000 miles with nothing to read. The two older girls stare at their little sister for dozens of Nebraska miles until Amelia breaks down and cries. It passes the time. Charlotte gives up trying to control them. No one suspects yet, but she has already begun to slip into the long, private place that each passing year will deepen. She sits in the front seat, navigating maps for her husband, and humming Chopin nocturnes under her breath. Dementia starts here, in these days of quiet, automotive sainthood. They camp near Slough Creek for 3 days. The younger girls spend hours playing old maid. Mimi joins her father in the stream. The shared lassitude of casting, the sea of the line as it lengthens in the air, that four-stroke swelling rhythm with the stiff hands stopping at 10 and 2, the ripple of the dry fly as it alights on the water, her small dread that something might actually strike, the startle of the fish's mouth when it breaks the surface, these are charmed to her and will stay so forever. Knee-deep in the cold current, her father is free. He maps the sandbars, measures the speed of the water, reads the bottom, watches for hatch, those simultaneous equations and multiple unknowns that one must solve to think like a fish, all the while conscious of nothing but the sheer luck of being on the water. "Why these fish hiding?" he asks his daughter. "What they do?" This is how she'll remember him, wading in his heaven. Fishing, he has solved life. Fishing, he passes the final exam, the next arhat, joining the ones in the mysterious scroll at the bottom of his closet that Mimi has continued to visit in secret over the years. She's old enough now to know that the men in the scroll are not her ancestors, but seeing her father like this, on the river, complete and at peace, she cannot help but think he's their descendant. Charlotte sits in a camping chair by the side of the river. Her only job is to unsnag the lines of the two fishermen, untying Byzantine microscopic knots hour after hour. Winston watches the sun set over the river, the reeds going from gold to dun.
"Look the color!"
And again, a few minutes later, a whisper to himself under the sky's collapsing cobalt.
"Look the color."
There are colors in his spectrum that no one else can see. They picnic on the shores of a small lake not far off the road toward Tower Junction. Mimi and Carmen look for stones to make into jewelry. Charlotte and Amelia begin their 17th consecutive game of Chinese checkers. Winston sits in a foldable camping chair, updating his notebooks. There's a funny motion near the table. Amelia shouts, "Bear!" Charlotte leaps up, sending the game board flying. She lifts her youngest daughter into the air and dashes into the lake. The bear ambles toward the jewelry gatherers. Mimi checks for high shoulders or a sloping face. She must do one thing for grizzlies, the opposite for black bears. One climbs trees, the other doesn't. She can't remember which.
"Climb!"
she shouts to Carmen, and they each scramble up their own lodgepole. The bear, which could reach either of them in two easy scooches, loses interest. It stands on the lake shore, wondering if today might be a good day for a swim. It regards the chest-deep woman in the water, holding her tiny daughter on high like she's about to baptize the girl. It waits to see what the always insane species will do next. It wanders over to Winston, who has been sitting stock still at the camping table, taking pictures with the Nikon. The camera, the only Japanese item the man allows himself to own, goes click, snick, whirr. Winston rises to his feet as the animal approaches. Then he starts to chatter to the bear. In Chinese. A primitive toilet stands near the site, door open. Winston talks to the bear, cajoling it while edging toward the door. This baffles the bear, who reconsiders his whole approach to the situation. Sadness percolates up in him. He sits and claws at the air. Winston keeps talking. It astounds Mimi, this alien language coming from her father's mouth. Winston draws a handful of pistachios from his pocket and tosses them into the latrine. The bear ambles after them, grateful for the diversion.
"Get in car!"
Winston's shout whispers.
"Fast!"
They do, and the bear doesn't even lift its head. But Winston stops to retrieve the camping table and stools. He's paid good money for them, and he's not about to leave them behind. That night, at the campsite near Norris, Mimi asks him, awed. Her father has changed before her eyes.
"Weren't you afraid?"
He laughs, embarrassed.
"Not my time yet. Not my story."
The words chill her. How can he know his story ahead of time? But she doesn't ask him that. Instead, she says,
"What did you say to it?"
His brow crumples. He shrugs. What else is there to say to a bear?
"Apologize. I tell him people very stupid. They forget everything. Where they come from, where they go. I say, don't worry. Human being leaving this world very soon. Then the bear get top bunk to himself again."
At Holyoke, Mimi is a lug, lesbian until graduation. It's the same at half of the other Seven Sisters colleges, rounded up. Scissors and paste, they call it. Fun, sinning, healthy, shameful, sweet. Great practice for something. Life, say. Whatever happens after school. She reads 19th century American poetry and drinks afternoon tea in South Hadley for 3 semesters. It beats Wheaton. But one April day, she's reading Abbott's Flatland for a sophomore survey called Transcendence, when she reaches the part where the narrator, A. Square, gets lifted out of his plane into the expanses of Spaceland. Truth comes over her like a revelation. The only thing worth believing in is measurement. She must become an engineer, like her daddy before her. It's not even a choice. She's an engineer already, and always has been. And as with Abbott's Square, the minute she comes back to Flatland, her Holyoke friends want to lock her up. She transfers to Berkeley. Best place for ceramic engineering she can find. The place is a staggering time warp. Future masters of the universe study alongside unrepentant revolutionaries who believe the golden age of human potential peaked 10 years before. She thrives, reborn Mimi, looking like a diminutive Kazakh carrying a programmable calculator, and in the estimation of many, the cutest thing ever to mouth the Hall-Petch equation. She savors the eerie Stepford Wives climate. She sits in the eucalyptus grove, the trees that explode in the dry heat, solving problem sets and watching the protesters with their placards full of all-caps slogans. The better the weather, the more irate the demands. The month before graduation, she dons a killer interview suit, sleek, gray, professional, inexorable as a no-cal earthquake. She interviews with 8 campus reps and gets 3 offers. She takes a job as a casting process supervisor for a molding outfit in Portland because it offers the most chance to travel. They send her to Korea. She falls in love with the country. In 4 months, she learns more Korean than she knows Chinese. Her sisters, too, wander across the map. Carmen winds up at Yale, studying economics. Amelia gets a job nursing wounded wildlife in a discovery center in Colorado. Back in Wheaton, the Ma Mulberry is assailed on all fronts. Mealybugs cover it in cottony wisps. Scale insects mass on its branches, invulnerable to all her father's pesticides. Bacteria blacken the leaves. Her parents are helpless to save the thing. Charlotte, in her thickening fog, murmurs about bringing in a priest to pray over it. Winston pores through horticulture Bibles and fills his notebooks with impeccably printed speculations, but each season brings the tree closer to capitulation. Winston calls Mimi when she's back in Portland from another Korea trip. He reaches her from the family phone booth, the Ma Garage. His invention has shrunken down to the size of a hiking boot, so reliable and power thrifty that Bell Labs starts licensing it to other outfits. But Winston takes no pleasure in telling his daughter that his life's work has at last come to fruition. All he can talk about is his failed mulberry.
That tree, what he do?
What's wrong with it, Dad?
Bad color. All his leaves falling.
Have you tested the soil?
My silk farm. Finish. It never make one thread.
Maybe you should plant another.
Best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago.
Yep. And you always said the next best time was now.
Wrong. Next best time? 19 years ago.
Mimi has never heard this cheerful, endlessly resourceful man sound so low. Take a trip, Dad. Take Mom camping. But they've just come back from a 10,000-miler up to the salmon streams in Alaska, and the notebooks are filled with meticulous notes that will take years to go over. Put Mom on. There's a sound. The car door opening and closing, then the door to the garage. After a while, a voice says,
Salve, filia mea.
Mom? What the hell?
Ego latinam discunt.
Don't do this to me, Mom.
Vita est supplicium.
Put Dad back on. Dad? Is everything okay out there?
Mimi? My time coming.
What's that supposed to mean?
My work all done. My silk farm finish. Fishing going down. Little bit every year. What I do now?
What are you talking about? Do what you've always done. Make charts and graphs of next year's campsites. Fill up the basement with stacks of soap and soup and cereal and any other items that happen to go on sale. Fall asleep every night to the 10 o'clock news. Freedom.
Yes,
he says. But she knows the voice that formed her. Whatever he pretends that yes to mean, it's a lie. She makes a note to call her sisters and discuss the Wheaton collapse. Parents on the fritz. What to do? But long distance to the East Coast is $2 a minute if you don't have a magic shoe phone. She decides to write them both that weekend. But that weekend is her ceramic sintering conference in Rotterdam. And the letters slip her mind. In the fall, with his wife in the basement studying Latin, Winston Ma, once Ma Sir Shin to everyone who knew him, sits under the crumbling mulberry, and, with Verdi's Macbeth blasting out the bedroom window, puts a Smith & Wesson 686 with hardwood grips up to his temple and spreads the workings of his infinite being across the flagstones of the backyard. He leaves no note except a calligraphic copy of Wang Wei's 1,200-year-old poem left unfurled on parchment across the desk in his study. An old man, I want only peace. The things of this world mean nothing. I know no good way to live, and I can't stop getting lost in my thoughts, my ancient forests. The wind that waves the pines loosens my belt. The mountain moon lights me as I play my lute. You ask, how does a man rise or fall in this life? The fisherman's song flows deep under the river. Mimi is in SFO on her way to Seattle for a site inspection. She's mock-shopping the concourse when, out of the cacophony of gate calls and public service announcements, her name blares out. Something cold grabs at her scalp. Before the people at the customer service desk even hand her the phone, she knows. And all the way home to Illinois, she thinks, how do I recognize this already? Why does this all feel so much like remembering? Her mother is helpless.
Your father doesn't want to hurt us. He has some ideas. I don't understand all of them. That's just how he is.
Her words come from a place where the blast she heard from the basement is only one of several possibilities that branching time might try. She looks so gentled, so at peace in her confusion, so utterly under the surface of the flowing river that Mimi can do nothing but share her unreal calm. The job her father leaves is Mimi's to finish. No one has touched the scene, except to remove the body and the gun. Pieces of brain dot the stones and tree trunk, like new species of garden slug. She turns into a cleaning machine, bucket, sponge, soapy water, for the spattered deck. She failed to alert her sisters or stop what she saw happening, but she can do this, clean up the backyard carnage forever. Cleaning, she becomes another thing. The wind loosens her hair. She looks at the bloodied paving stones, the bits of soft tissue that housed his ideas.
She sees him by her side, amazed by the flecks of his own brain lying in the grass.
Look, the color!
You ask how people rise or fall in this life? Like this. She sits under the diseased mulberry. Wind slaps at the coarse-toothed leaves. Wrinkles score the bark, like the folds in the Arhat's faces. Her eyes sour with animal confusion. Even now, every square foot of ground is stained with fruit. Fruit stained, the myths say, with the blood of a suicide for love. Words come out of her, crumpled and tinny.
Dad. Daddy. What you do?
Then the silent howls. Carmen and Amelia arrive. United, the trio sit together one last time. They have no explanation. There never will be one. The least likely person in the world has gone on an impossible tour without them. In place of explanation, memory. They put their hands on each other's shoulders and tell each other stories of how things were. Sunday opera, the epic car journeys, trips to the lab where the tiny man floated down the halls, celebrated by all his giant white colleagues, the happy maker of the cellular future. They remember the day the family scattered from the bear, their mother holding Amelia above her head in the water, their father talking to the animal in Chinese. Two creatures, not quite of the same order, sharing the same woods. They hold a silent liturgy of memory and shock, but they hold it indoors. Mimi's sisters don't go near the yard. They can't even look at the old breakfast tree, their father's silk farm. Mimi tells them what she knows. The call.
My time coming.
Amelia holds her.
It's not your fault. You couldn't know.
Carmen says,
He told you that and you didn't tell us?
Charlotte sits nearby, smiling a little. It's like the family is still on a camping trip somewhere, and she is at lakeside, unsnagging the smallest knots in her husband's fishing line.
He hates it when you three fight.
Mom! Mimi shouts at the woman. Mom, enough! Clear your head! He's gone!
Gone?
Charlotte frowns at her daughter's foolishness.
What are you talking about? I'll see your father again.
The three girls attack the mountain of paperwork and reporting. It has never before occurred to Mimi. The law doesn't stop with death. It reaches far beyond the grave, for years, entangling the survivors in bureaucratic hurdles that make the challenges of pre-death seem like a cakewalk. Mimi tells the others,
We have to divvy up his stuff.
Divvy? Carmen says. You mean, like, take? Amelia says,
Shouldn't we let Mom?
You see how she is. She's not even here.
Carmen rears up.
Can you stop solving problems for a minute? What's the hurry?
I'd like to get things done, for Mom.
By throwing out his stuff?
Distribute. Each thing to the right person.
Like solving a big quadratic equation.
Carmen, we have to take care of it.
Why? You want to sell the house out from under Mom?
Like she's going to be able to take care of it by herself, in her state? Amelia puts her arms around them both.
Maybe those things can wait for now? We only have a little while to be with each other.
We're all here now, Mimi says. It could be a long time before that happens again.
Let's just get it done.
Carmen shakes free of the hug.
So, you're not coming home for Christmas?
But something in her tone is as good as a signed confession. Home has gone wherever their father went. Charlotte clings to a few token things. This is his favorite sweater.